Pastor Ralph Mullery, who is the campus pastor at the University of California at Berkeley. He'll be speaking to us on the challenges of the campus ministry this morning. Pastor Mullery is with us here at Concordia Seminary because he is using the library and the facilities of the Historical Institute to work on a thesis for a PhD degree at Harvard University, and also because he is working on a manuscript of a book for Fortress Press called The Christian Conscience and Negro Emancipation. Pastor Mullery has written extensively also on subjects of race relations and communism, as well as upon campus ministry. Pastor Mullery.
Members of the faculty and fellow students, I hadn't intended to mention it, but standing here once again reminds me that somewhere along about in the mid-40s was the last time that I did so. And seeing the honor conferred upon Dr. Brecher this morning reminds me again of my seminary days when I sat in his classroom. And being back on the campus now after 20 years or so, I do want to take advantage of this opportunity for what it is worth to publicly commend the faculty and the administration and the current student body for the things that I see going on here. It seems to me there has been tremendous progress in many ways, and I, for one, rejoice over some of the developments that I see. In fact, I don't know what this says for the seminary or what it says about me, but I haven't been able to really get into any serious disputation upon my arrival here. And from the advanced billing in the quad, augmented by certain unofficial publications on the fringe of Synod, you might gain the impression that I'm something of a controversial figure, and that wherever I go, I spread controversy. This morning, I hope if nothing else is accomplished, that my appearance here will disabuse you of this illusion, and seeing me in person, I hope it won't be too shattering a disappointment, really, to find out what a tranquil and peaceful person I am, how I represent such moderation and serenity. Of course, there have been, I must admit, a few exceptions here and there. One that comes to mind is a few years back when I was at Valparaiso University for an all-day symposium on communism, and I delivered two essays on the occasion. And it was a rather long and arduous day. And at the very end, after the panel was breaking up, lo and behold, first I was accosted by a student from the University of Chicago in Slavic languages who was furious because I had not accepted Khrushchev's definition of coexistence and because I was entirely too hard on the communists. And no sooner was he through raking me over the coals than I was accosted by some men on the other side of the political spectrum who were ready to take me to task, almost literally grasping me by the coat, to demand that I repeat under oath before the House Un-American Activities Committee everything that I had said about Herbert Philbrick.
There have been these incidents,
but today it is good to know that I have before me an audience of remarkable restraint and moderation, and therefore need to anticipate none of these violent reactions. I suppose it's somewhat presumptuous for me to step before you and to try to pose some authority on the campus ministry when you have on your own faculty a couple of veterans in this field who could speak very authoritatively, Dr. Klan and Dr. Defner, who have been in this work for many years. But let me plunge into the subject, and we will hope that at least few of the thoughts expressed may give you some impressions of what we who are serving full-time in the campus ministry are seeking to accomplish. What is this challenge of the campus ministry that we're talking about? About 6 months ago, William Horton prepared a report about a discovery he had completed after surveying a dozen college campuses. And three of his conclusions, I would think, are worth noting by way of introduction to our own commentary on the campus ministry. He found, first, that today's student is likely to go into religious hibernation during his college years, something that we really have to bear in mind. There has been a tendency for many students to simply play hooky from the church to forget about it during the 4 or 6 years that they are on the campus. Secondly, that he may lose his faith in college, which is what has generally been the impression, but that he is more likely to find faith, which is probably not quite as well known. And thirdly, that he is seeking and hoping to find a meaning for his life. And unfortunately, Dr. Horderin adds that usually he does not find this meaning provided by the church. Most state universities, Horderin observes, have more students of any one denomination than are enrolled in that denomination's largest college. This would be true for us except for Valparaiso. But only slowly are the denominations awakening to the opportunity of the state campus. Without doubt, an increasing percentage of our students will be in state universities. The churches need to rethink their relation to higher education. Some real progress has been made in the state universities, and some of the most exciting Christian groups are to be found there. But the laborers for this harvest are still few. Well, it was certainly a joy and delight to me to learn that your mission society has centered on the campus ministry as its project for this year. I would agree that this is certainly of top importance. Mission, in both the broader and the narrow sense of the term, is what the church finds in the present population explosion on the campus. We know that campuses are growing and expanding, and new campuses are building up everywhere, particularly in the large population centers. At the University of California, we now have, just in our own branch at Berkeley, some 25,000 plus students enrolled, with imagine 8,000 of these being graduate students, and the eventual expectation being that 12,000 students above the AB level will be resident on this campus. So the church simply has a mission to perform where there are so many people to be reached. The needs and opportunities are simply enormous where so many young minds are being shaped and where the thought patterns for the future are being charted. Now, in the more restricted sense of gaining conversions or of influencing uncommitted people on the college campus, we have all too recently realized that here also is a tremendous mission field. More than 1,200 students and faculty were drawn into membership in our own church through adult confirmation over the last 3 years by our campus pastors. In Choirs After Truth, Unsettled Youth, especially coming into a new atmosphere, who may have been unapproachable elsewhere, we find that they are ready here to listen in many instances, especially if we can find new and exciting ways of presenting the good news. So a top priority mission project this is indeed, if we are really alert to what is going on in the world today. Now, before I proceed any further, let me whet your appetite a bit further for this subject, if I may, and submit that the graduates of Concordia Seminary, in a much greater degree in the years ahead, are going to have to be concerned about what goes on the college campuses, about ministering to the intellectual, or at least to the educated American. This is because we can't any longer say that this is just the specialization of a relatively few full-time campus pastors that have to be aware of this. To be sure, these men who are serving at large universities full-time have special reason to equip themselves for approaches to the intelligentsia. But in the broader purview, and for several reasons, it strikes me that nearly all the future graduates of Concordia Seminary will need to acquire an understanding of our church's ministry to secular institutions of higher learning. For one thing, a much higher proportion of our own constituency already boasts a post-high school training than was formerly the case, and we can be sure that this trend will continue. On the first Sunday after Christmas, by way of pulpit appearance, I was back in the home community where I was reared, now a semi-rural area, then a totally small town, rural area, and I recall that in the 1930s, there were even a few of our sons and daughters who terminated their education after the eighth grade in our Lutheran school. Most of them went on to the public high school, but only a few exceptional individuals really ventured on into higher education. But now, 30 years later, this is quite different, and now we find a fairly large proportion of young people from a community like this having the ambition to go on after high school. So if the bulk of the Missouri Synod was once composed of German peasants, it isn't true any longer. This means then that our preaching and our counseling and our organizational activities will gradually have to be geared to a higher level of cultural expression and intellectual understanding. More than this, it immediately implies that parish pastors will need to be searching for and contriving new ways of preparing their young people for this crucial period of life, when they must break away from their home environment, their associations in the church, to enter a new atmosphere, a very trying atmosphere where their character and their sense of values are sorely tested and further developed for good or ill throughout the remainder of their lives. I think I can say without fear of contradiction that this is the greatest problem that we have at the present time in the campus ministry, is that we find ever so many young people coming to the college whose religious understanding is still back on the child's level. Somehow, it has never gone beyond the stage of confirmation, and during those high school years, nothing of consequence has happened to prepare them for what strikes them when they get into this academic community. One common complaint among campus pastors is that many of their Lutheran students have received no conditioning whatsoever, or they have received only negative admonitions and communion cards to prepare for this transitional stage of Sturm und Drang through which they must pass in their lives. Too often in the past, preparation for attending what were regarded as godless colleges consisted in warnings against the satanic snares of the evolutionary theory. And it seems almost this way, I don't think it's too much of an exaggeration, as though confirmands were indoctrinated above all else to feel that six-day instantaneous creation dated 6 to 10,000 years ago was the primary article of faith to be defended against all comers, against all atheistic scientists and blasphemers. Now, what has happened when this approach has been used, as many campus pastors can testify, is something like this. You have a few stalwarts who tenaciously cling to the traditional interpretation, come what may, and somehow survive the conflict. There are others, however, who develop a dichotomy in their thinking and begin to rigidly make a separation between everything that happens in their scientific investigations and in their Christian life. For them, laboratory and church never intersect, because if they did, they would likely find some devastating conflicts and contradictions. And all the while, for too many honest souls, there comes a shattering disillusionment. In their freshman year, they take up their cudgels to do battle for the Christian cause by disproving the asseverations of their scientific instructors, by disproving the contentions of these evolutionists, by resorting perhaps to the quasi-scientific arguments that their pastors may have presumptuously fortified them with, and only to find that by the time they get along into their sophomore year, it would seem, at least in their estimation, that their instructors have more information and seem to have overwhelming arguments, and then they sink back into a sea of doubt and resentment. So the final resolve here is that the props have been pulled out from under them, and they feel that all is lost. Now, I could document this with personal experiences. Last year, the most vociferous agnostic on the campus of the University of California was an ex-Missouri Synod Lutheran who had gone through approximately this same experience. When I entered into, in fact, he brought over with him a cousin who was also an ex-Missouri Synod Lutheran agnostic, and the two of them resolved that they were going to convert me. And we spent a few hours together one night. But it soon became apparent that here was a clear case of a couple of fellows who had no theological comprehension, had no idea of how to relate their present learning to their Christian faith, and who had simply been victims of hearing some rather crude attacks upon Christianity. While I was back in Berkeley last September, I managed to draw into prolonged conversation a child prodigy, in fact, a parochial school graduate, one who was so eccentric that he was lecturing on specializations in biology while he was unwilling to conform enough to qualify for a high school diploma. And he was so brilliant at this point that despite resistance from university authorities, he had now arranged to enroll for 30 graduate units without attending most of the classes. Now, this young man
regrettably enough, was alienated from the church because scientific judgments, which he found untenable already in his childhood, had been, as he put it, crammed down his throat and made binding on his conscience. Now, one might dismiss characters like this as beatniks or rebels or eccentrics, but they're only the few among the many who encounter a needless conflict of this kind. If their pastors, I would say, had only been more sympathetic listeners, and if they had just been a little more hesitant, a little less willing to supply dogmatic answers, this in itself might have been enough to have saved their souls from spiritual, saved these people from spiritual shipwreck. Now it is my impression that this situation is improving and has already improved. We don't want our youth to feel that their faith stands or falls on a particular interpretation of Genesis or on efforts, on our own efforts, to reconcile science and scripture. And with the present crop of enlightened seminarians graduating into the field, I'm confident that these shades of night will give way more and more to the dawn of greater wisdom and discretion. Well, what I was seeking to establish before I was detoured into this elongated parenthesis was simply this. A vast majority of present and future parish pastors have an important obligation to perform in devising sound procedures to follow, in equipping youth for their college days, absorbing the shocks and lessening the jolts, yes, but even more significant, urging them on toward a positive expression of their faith, in emphasizing the crucial aspects of participation in corporate worship, sacramental nurture, and theological understanding. More attention will have to be given in the years ahead to preparation for college in our parishes, as well as to how to preserve continuing and meaningful links with the young people who are away from home. Therefore, I was pleased to know that in our forthcoming Campus Pastors Conference, the first week in February, Reverend Elmer Witt, Executive Secretary of the Walpa League, will be speaking on this very subject, preparing our youth for college. Now, another reason why you should be interested in the campus ministry, above and beyond remembering that it is one of the vital, most vital mission fields for the church as a whole, is to realize that many of you are actually going to be needed to serve in at least part-time capacities, probably as town gown parsons, as the Commission on College and University Work likes to refer to it. Many a city and town congregation is already in close proximity to a state college or a medical center or a hospital where nurses are in training or a junior college at least or a business school. And so it will. These places are going to need special attention. It won't do to pretend that we're already preoccupied with other duties or that the present parish program that we have should be adequate. We're going to have to devise some different approaches to be used here, something different in counseling and in discussion groups and in service projects. Right here, a considerable proportion of seminary graduates can expect to be drafted for work among students and campus personnel. This morning, however, I would like to rush on to focus attention primarily on the prospects as we find them at major universities, although you can make appropriate application to the smaller colleges. What is our job? What are our objectives on the campus? Included in our vocabulary for some years now have been the familiar terms conservation, reclamation, recruitment, and training for churchmanship. Now, these terms have served well, and they have a connotation which I'm sure is quite obvious to most of you, and they are well to keep in mind, and they will remain important. The implication of these terms should, however, be supplemented by some new thoughts. And today I would like to fill in the description of these functions and point toward some other possibilities through the interpretation of some other labels that I would suggest. One realistic appraisal of the role assumed by the campus pastor would be to say that he is an outsider with an axe to grind. In most instances, this means he is not an integral part of the university with faculty status.
or a direct voice in policy making. An exception in the Missouri Synod would be Dr. Paul Meyer at Western Michigan, who holds the rank of assistant professor of history, and all the while is serving as a pastor to our students there. An even more rare exception would be a case like Dr. Lewis Spitz, Jr., who received a theological training at Concordia Seminary and then became a professional historian who serves at Stanford University, makes a tremendous impact as a Christian in the classroom, but does not directly assume any of the prerogatives of a campus pastor. But for the most part, our campus pastors are on the periphery, a situation which may have some disadvantages, but which can be converted into a strategic posture if it causes them to function in what I have described in a recent article in the Triangle as the threefold role of enabler, of catalyst, and of complementary educator. Now, to sketch for you a little more fully some of the present and future possibilities that I envision on the campus ministry, I will make reference to these three categories. As an enabler, the campus pastor does not pretend to be a professional expert to whom the task is exclusively confided. Rather, he becomes the one who stimulates, who encourages, who upbuilds the whole community of faith. Stressing the ministry of the laity, he equips and sustains students in their mission of witnessing in dormitory and classroom. By preaching the word and administering the sacraments in the whole context of college life, the pastor seeks to make vivid the mighty acts of God for the reclamation of humanity. On Sunday mornings and at other regular intervals, the captain, you might say, calls together his team for instruction in Christian doctrines and for a rehearsal of the tactics which they can employ. Here is the opportunity for students to gain firsthand experience in presenting the Christian verities to people with a variety of backgrounds and interests. Future engineers and enthusiasts for the natural sciences usually predominate, but there will also be the political science and French major, or the person preparing to be a lawyer or a social worker. In Berkeley, we have urged students to speak to other students wherever they have the chance, whether it be a casual conversation in the student union or in connection with an art festival that is being prepared, or after the football game. As far as possible, we try to induce students to call on other students, campus evangelism. At a place like the University of California, we have a chance to reach many international students. And so this may imply regular contact with Muslims, Buddhists, and Hindus. A few years ago, we ran a series of discussions on world religions and brought in student representatives of these faiths from Japan and Hong Kong and Iran. For the last 3 years, we've had a Hindu from Bombay who has surprisingly presented himself almost every morning in the chapel at worship and has come back on Sunday evenings for the cost suppers and the programs. A year ago, we gave him a chance to, at his own request, to speak to us on Gandhian truth, little knowing that we were letting ourselves in for a lecture of almost 2 hours duration. But at any rate, what Dr. Defner has called friendship evangelism has shown its effect. And we have our own students living at International House, only a few blocks from our chapel, who are encouraged to bring their acquaintances along from Egypt and Nigeria and Guatemala or even Israel. In the case of our friend Bhaskar from Bombay, when he moved to Reno, Nevada and took a job there for a while, he wrote to us and he complained about his loneliness and suggested that we have a Gamma Delta retreat in his area. that proved impossible, lo and behold, a few months later, he greeted us on the streets of Berkeley again. He really has felt very close to us. Yet for him to repudiate formally his ties with Hinduism would mean we have to understand disgrace at home and many personal disabilities. Yet we're inclined to suspect that he is already unconsciously becoming a Christian after being exposed to the gospel so frequently. Now, in all of this, it was not so much that I, as a professional clergyman, was influencing Bhaskar. I may have had something to do with enabling our students to become the leaven that worked on him. Another illustration of what I have in mind by saying that the campus pastor can serve as an enabler might be to tell you about the Agnostics Night that we initiated last spring. In upholding the central affirmation of justification by faith, it seems to me that a Lutheran is compelled to assert that the Christian is free, and that the Christian is free to ask every conceivable question about existence, meaning, reason, or the cosmos. We don't have to shy away from these matters. Accordingly, I deliberately invited three deeply disturbed individuals with exceptional intelligence to join in a sort of open-end discussion, with the president of our congregation being the only Christian present. And he is a Harvard grad, a PhD candidate in political science, who is perfectly well qualified to hold his own without any pastoral interference. Let me tell you why. Incidentally, this young man who worked last summer in the Pentagon and who has become a teaching assistant this year is a good illustration of what we love to see really witnessing on the graduate level. This fellow has had the nerve to insert in his term papers or seminar presentations certain value judgments, non-objective, Christian-grounded judgments. And for this unscholarly attitude, he has been penalized sometimes with a C or D grade. But what has happened is that he has succeeded in having it raised to an A, because he goes in and talks to the professor in question and is persuasive enough to convince him that his point is well taken and his grade is elevated. Well, that's the caliber of men we like to see doing this sort of thing. Another of the participants in our Skeptics Night was the ex-Missouri agnostic that I mentioned before, who gained notoriety by writing a series of letters in the Daily Californian, our campus paper, quoting from Bertrand Russell's Why I'm Not a Christian on the problem of evil and suffering. Another fellow we drew in was an extremely brilliant but emotionally unstable graduate student in mathematics, a graduate of the University of Chicago, also a product of our parochial schools. At this point, on the verge of a mental collapse, in the midst of a profound quest for some purpose in life. Very interesting case. I called on him a year ago last October, and immediately I knew that there would be no reaction from this fellow. I was rather coolly received, and as I expected, he didn't show up at chapel. But about 6 months later, all of a sudden, one Sunday morning, in he comes at 9:45 already with a Bible in hand, asking, "What does the Bible class mean?" And later on, I discovered that what had happened was that, according to his own confession, he had a sort of father fixation, and his father had died, leaving him in a state of complete confusion. Now, at this time, it happened that Paul Tillich was making an appearance at the University of California. By the way, drew, I understand, the largest audience he's ever had in the United States, which says something about our campus, where no other religious figure is ever greeted in this way. Billy Graham probably wouldn't get much of a response. But anyway, at this point, our disturbed friend, I started reading Paul Tillich. And I must say that with his superior intelligence, he seemed to be understanding him. I can't say that as a result of this experience, I would recommend readings in Paul Tillich for consolation or helpfulness to disturbed people. It only seemed to aggravate the situation. Parenthetically here, it was through this individual that I discovered for myself, or rediscovered, the great value in personal, private confession. For this seemed to be one of the most helpful things in his case, was private confession. Well, the fourth participant in our Agnostics Night was an honor student in chemistry with a Christian science background and a strong yen for psychology. He had been enrolled in a Christian doctrine course I had taught a year earlier, excelled all others, including 12 lifelong Lutherans, was baptized and confirmed, and he then relapsed into a state of spiritual uncertainty. At the moment, he was hovering somewhere between Jungian psychology and Zen Buddhism, his two latest kicks. Well, the upshot of the whole evening was that I sat back and I tuned in on what proved to be a most exciting presentation. By limiting myself to the role of moderator, I was carrying on my version of being an enabler for the night. Obviously, the whole affair had a tremendous therapeutic value, All three of these individuals had been under psychiatric treatment at one time or another, and the three searching individuals agreed to reconvene at a later date. Last September, I rejoiced to see the chemistry major turned psychologist back at worship, and he volunteered the good tidings that he was now ready to resume his status as a Christian. Another way in which you might talk about this being an enabler is to talk about the dialogue movement that you see so often on the campus today. We had a Christian Science representative in one time, authenticated by the Mother Church in Boston. And then we had Dr. Lewis Spitz that I mentioned before in confrontation with a Jesuit priest on the subject, why was the Reformation necessary? I understand the largest crowd ever had that we ever had at the chapel outside of the day of dedication. Well, the second label that I used to expound the duties of a campus pastor was that of catalyst. In biblical language, this would be the rendering of prophetic judgments. Amos and Jeremiah were the catalysts of ancient Israel. As a catalyst, the campus pastor will be constantly obliged to disturb the status quo and upset the apathetic. Repeatedly, he will be asking, what does it mean for a person who has been reconciled with God to be reconciled with his fellows, with the world? And how can the oppressive economic and political structures in society be humanized? What are the implications of the gospel for the university, for our work at the university? Not having a vested interest in the institutional concerns, the campus pastor should be able to serve as a more objective critic. And part of his leadership responsibility may be to set an example in working for social justice and academic freedom. The institutional church has been accused, quite rightfully, I fear, of lagging behind secular agencies in seeking the alleviation of social distress. But a denominational structure finds it difficult to rise above the level of understanding and sensitivity of conscience displayed by its constituents. In the Missouri Synod, there's so much in our cultural background, there are so many sociological factors as well as theological misunderstandings that have made us particularly oblivious to social concern. I'm acutely aware of this because that happens to be the topic for my doctoral dissertation. Well, certainly one way in which this appalling gap in our performance up to the present can be filled is through the instruction that we give and through the precedents which are set in the Lutheran campus community. Here we find exuberant, idealistic youth prepared to champion the cause of the underdog and join a freedom ride or a civil rights demonstration or join the Peace Corps. Many of them are not ready to settle for the prevailing standards and leave them unchallenged. At least they are more receptive to new ideas and new possibilities for change in the economic and political realms. Now this youthful energy and excitability can go awry and erupt into a riot against the House Un-American Activities Committee, as it did for our students at the University of California a few years ago. Or it may be challenged into more constructive enterprises, like working with the teenagers of minority groups to keep them off the streets and upgrade them for working, upgrade the teenagers for obtaining more skilled jobs, something which we've also seen happen. Nowhere in any event is there a better chance for the catalyst to point up the foibles of our society and jar his students into action. Through developing an enlightened social conscience among the educated laity of our church, it is conceivable that some light may shine and that the vocations of our people may be accompanied by acts that are truly meaningful and helpful in our anxiety-ridden revolutionary world. The third term that I used to describe the position of the campus pastor was that of complementary educator. As a complementary educator, he should, as I see it, be grateful for what the university undertakes, but eager to overcome the lack of biblical theological understanding that usually prevails. So the teaching of religion, in view of the religious illiteracy that is usually found on the college campus, is one of the most indispensable undertakings for the campus pastor. Wherever credit or non-credit courses in religion can be taught, you will want to grasp the opportunity. At the University of California in Berkeley, as some of you may have heard, we are experimenting with the Lutheran Center of Studies, where future lawyers, engineers, and scientists can mature in their theological thinking, and where students recruited for professional church work can enroll for classes in biblical studies, church history, social ethics, and Christian thought. Other vehicles for alerting private colleges and state universities to the significance of Christian claims may be found in the formation of special interest groups. These may be arranged according to profession or major, with, for example, medical students convening to inquire about what our Christian commitment has to say to them in terms of the location of a doctor and the medical dilemmas that he faces. Fellows and co-eds with unusual aptitude in art, music, and literature can be stimulated to use these media of expression for reflection of their Christian faith and insights. From gifted young artists, we can anticipate the development of new contemporary forms for architecture, liturgy, hymnology, and chancel drama. Many observers have complained about the paucity of high-quality Christian writing in our day. So perhaps we can capture the mind and imagination of some budding geniuses that may eventually compose some striking poetry and some really masterful novels. Students, we know, are in an impressionable age when their convictions and their general outlook on life are being molded. So let us not be timid or backward about confronting them with the greatest challenge that the world has ever known. To be advocates, exponents, reflectors of this new and dynamic life which has been brought to us through the resurrected Christ. Another experiment, which we have in view at Berkeley, which is already being tested by the NLC at the State University of Iowa, and which would combine all three roles of the campus pastor as enabler, catalyst, and complementary educator, is the concept of a company of the committed, with a number of novitiates or inquirers added, living together for 1 or 2 years of their college career in a community where a community of their own, where they can grow toward a higher level of discipleship. What is called the Christus House at Iowa City speaks of these four convictions that undergird its formation. First, it calls it life together, ala Bonhoeffer. Second is covenant, the agreement to share in the common meals and directed conversation, all the other features agreed upon by the community. Third is study, with a four unit curriculum outlined, and fourth is worship, the way in which Christian identity is clarified, the way in which Christians discover the divine reality which is theirs in Christ. Now, I had a few other thoughts that I wanted to conclude with here, but I think I'll break off at this point because time has gotten away from us, and give you a chance to respond in the closing minutes. I simply wanted to say something finally about what I conceive to yet be the problem of anti-intellectualism as we face it in our church. But what I think is crucial for all of us, whether we are parish pastors or whether we are campus pastors, is that we now stimulate our young people to move ahead with their high calling in Christ and to make their contribution with their varied gifts toward the erection of the temple of God, toward the high ideal which is ours as Christians. And so I would propose that we all be eager to work together jointly for manifestations of the Spirit and to excel in the building up of the church. I thank you for the opportunity to be with you today. I wouldn't want to say that it's impossible to step out of your life right here and to be effective. However, I would, of course, experience is always helpful, and probably a certain amount of seasoning
and awareness of what is going on in various sectors of American and church life is valuable for any campus pastor beyond simply the training that is received in college and seminary. I would distinguish here, I think, between the full-time campus pastorate and the part-time campus pastorate, as I was alluding to it. I think that eventually, in the case of the full-time campus pastor, my answer would be yes, that you should have some specialized training. Now, I don't think that this should lead to the assumption that for one to be effective in the campus ministry, he has to have an encyclopedic knowledge of all fields, which is obviously ridiculous in our day, or even that he needs to have any deep comprehension of the specialties of the laity, who especially those in the graduate fields. I indicated this a little before, that what is most crucial is that a person is a good listener, that he's willing to learn from his own people, from his own students, and that he doesn't pontificate on subjects in which he doesn't have a competence. At the same time, I believe it would be immensely valuable if a campus pastor follows through, what shall we say, some avocation, maybe. Maybe this could be something closely related to theology, not necessarily directly in the field of theology, which he pursues on the graduate level. I think it is necessary for him to sample courses around in the university where he is serving, to know what's going on by direct experience, to be exposed himself to the classroom. And in this way, I think he can fill in. Now, preferably, I think, on the long run, for the full-time campus pastor, even higher degrees in graduate work are significant. I think it would be overall a help. I would agree with Dr. Stendahl. We're battling with this thing at the University of California right now. Probably no place in the country is the wall of separation between church and state set up so rigidly as it is there. And there has been a movement among the students themselves calling for a chair of religion to be established. The Theological Graduate Union, which includes the Episcopalians and the Lutherans and the Baptists, in the Bay Area, have been trying to work toward at least some recognition of their theological courses by the university. Here we have six seminaries in a place like Berkeley, and there's no recognition of their coursework, really, on the part of the university, at least not a real interchange. This also makes it difficult in our case for accreditation of coursework which we offer. But I think that for the universities themselves to recognize that theology is a bona fide subject, and that education is really incomplete if one doesn't have the opportunity to develop his thinking along these lines, or at least that this should be part of the general university curriculum. Now, I think this is a step forward. There have been a couple of lawyers, law professors out at the University of California who have been arguing this point, suggesting that it isn't valid for professional philosophers, professional historians, people teaching in English literature to feel that they are fully doing justice to the whole subject of Christian theology or world religion. Now, I maybe just to supplement that a bit, I think we should cooperate with these efforts wherever we can and then supplement them with our own specific course offerings. Obviously, the university is not going to teach a course in the Lutheran Confessions or in Christian doctrine that would lead to confirmation in the church. These things we'll certainly have to continue doing ourselves. As you may know, there are some instances around the country where we have been able to set up our own Lutheran chairs of religion, like at the University of Southern California, at the University of Illinois, and I think there are a few others that are in the offering. Anyone else? If not, why... I'm sure that you leave fully aware that I never do utter a provocative syllable, and that this has been a very moderate presentation. Thank you.